Hello, and welcome to today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Thursday, June 11th, 2020. I'm your reader, Ralph Skippers. In looking at today's front page, we see local leaders hope economy rebounds after hitting bottom, and mechanical menagerie. But we'll start with county still waiting for Sunnycrest testing kits. Officials say they might pursue local options if state does not deliver COVID-19 tests today. By Benjamin Fisher. 5 days after Sunnycrest Manor in Dubuque announced that an employee had tested positive for COVID-19, test collection kits from the Iowa Department of Public Health still had not arrived. Sunnycrest Administrator Chris Kirsch informed the Dubuque County Board of Supervisors on Wednesday that despite her requesting the kits on Friday, when the positive case was discovered, the facility still was waiting. All preparatory work we can do here is done. Labels for all the bottles. All lab requisition sheets for residents and staff have been completed, she said. Visiting Nurse Association is going to help with staff testing, so Sunnycrest licensed nursing staff can do resident testing. I'm just waiting for the FedEx man to come to see if he has our shipment. The infected staff member had no direct resident contact and had last been at the facility on June 2nd. Local officials had said Monday morning that they expected the kits later that day. Plans called for all of the about 160 staff and all residents to be tested. Kirsch said she then was told by an Iowa Department of Public Health representative on Tuesday to expect kits Wednesday or today, but received no guarantee. Many nursing homes are trying to get testing to enter phase two for opening, she said. She said they are overloaded. I'm sure they're overloaded by many nursing homes asking for those testing kits. County Public Health Executive Director Patrice Lambert said she, too, tried to secure the kits for Sunnycrest as quickly as possible by contacting IDPH. I think we did everything we could have possibly done, she said. Last week, Governor Kim Reynolds announced a phased process through which long-term care facilities can open to visitors, a practice that has been banned since March due to the pandemic. The first phase requires the testing of all staff and residents. Supervisor Ann McDonough said half-jokingly that the county might have been better off handling things locally. It seems like we could get on Test Iowa, go to Sunnycrest, load up people and drive them to Cedar Rapids and back faster than we could get tests to Dubuque, she said. Supervisor Jay Wickham recommended strongly again to begin collecting samples with kits on hand rather than waiting. Why can't we secure the test from United Clinical Laboratories locally and use that inventory and their method to fulfill the order, he asked. If you wait for Des Moines, wait for Washington, D.C., you'll be disappointed. We're all crying in our soup here when we have the ability to do it locally. Kirsch shared the group's frustration but said she was wary of deviating from directives from the state unless she was sure of the processes by which that would be done. If I get those other test kits, then who is my courier? Who is going to run them? Where are the results going to go? She asked. This is a coordinated effort through LabCorp. They have a succinct process in place. I would like to be involved in developing any new process before I say yes. County Supervisor Dave Baker said that if the state has not delivered tests by today, he would support pursuing local testing. He said to prevent these delays in the future, he might support that anyway. We should have things prepared to do this locally so that we don't have to wait on the state, he said. If they're not going to provide the service, we need to take care of our citizens in a timely manner. The state was able to send a team of surveyors to Sunnycrest on Monday to monitor staff procedures and policies. That, Kirsch said, the facility passed with flying colors. County Board of Supervisors Interim Executive Director Ed Raber reported Wednesday that Dubuque County also still is waiting on an answer to whether a Test Iowa site will come to the county. Last week, county officials received word that they could have a Test Iowa site for COVID-19 sample collections if they could partner with a local healthcare facility to conduct the collections. A few facilities' administrators responded with questions about how the sites would work, which were passed on to IDPH. The agency has not responded. Meanwhile, Braber has talked to other counties where clinic-based sites are located already to find some of those answers himself. Next, local leaders hope economy rebounds after hitting bottom. Iowa Business Council's Virtual Vision to Vitality Forum examines impact of virus pandemic on Dubuque businesses by Thomas J. Barton. Dubuque's economic recovery from the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic is a bit of a good news, bad news situation that will weigh heavily on consumer confidence and workforce training, according to area business leaders. The good news is we do believe, economically, in terms of job loss and unemployment, that we have hit bottom, said Kristen Zietzel, Vice President of Workforce Solutions at Greater Dubuque Development Corp. However, the bad news is the bottom was pretty deep and ugly, Dietzel said. The Iowa Business Council held its first virtual Vision to Vitality Forum of the year with Dubuque community and business leaders on Wednesday. Panelists from IBC, Greater Dubuque Development Corp., the Dubuque Area Chamber of Commerce, Alliant Energy, and Northeast Iowa Community College discussed the local economic impact of the pandemic, barriers and solutions to workforce development efforts, Dubuque's past successes in confronting challenges, and its need for recovery. From mid-March through the end of May, 12,900 unemployment claims were filed within Dubuque County. Claims filed in the month of April alone exceeded those filed in all of 2019. April's unemployment rate stood at 12.7%, about 5% higher than was seen during the peak of the last recession. It's really been a pretty quick and devastating impact in terms of job loss, Dietzel said. We lost about 8,600 jobs for our county, which represents about 16 years of growth. Sectors most impacted included food service, hospitality, retail, and healthcare, followed by manufacturing layoffs in May as a recession took hold due to a disruption in supply chains and reductions in orders. The good news is we're starting to see a rebound, Dietzel said. New claims for the week of June were down significantly, and continued claims for those already on unemployment have started to decline, she said, showing individuals are starting to come back to the workforce. Those businesses will come back in the order they were impacted, Dietzel said. We expect, of course, to see those manufacturing jobs probably come back slower. We do expect the climb back to be much slower than the fall down. Key to the region's economic recovery will be a return of consumer confidence, panelists said. I really think about how we get these small businesses back on their feet, said Terry Kuba, President of Interstate Power and Light Company and Senior Vice President of Alliant Energy. And how to get those folks employed, and how do we do that safely and keep those folks as healthy as possible? Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds on Wednesday announced that capacity restrictions for Iowa businesses soon will be eliminated. As of 8 a.m. Friday, June 12th, businesses such as bars, restaurants, theaters, and retail locations no longer will be required to limit their occupancy to 50% of their standard capacity, a mandate that has been in place since those operations began reopening last month. According to U.S. Chamber of Commerce, 79%, nearly 8 in 10 U.S. businesses, have partially or fully opened. And just as important as safety for returning workers is community perception of safety, where community members feel comfortable patronizing reopened businesses, said Molly Grover, president and CEO of Dubuque Area Chamber of Commerce. How do we make sure our consumers have confidence, our clients and customers have confidence, and that our employees feel safe, Grover said. That was by far and away the highest answer in terms of biggest challenge, according to a survey of chamber members. Grover said the chamber is working on pushing out information to its members on best practices for reopening and messaging to employees, consumers, and customers. Adding to that challenge is the lack of a comprehensive testing program locally, where the average person can get a test if they have symptoms. That will change the reality, and it will change the actions that employers can implement to keep safe at work practices, Dietzel said. The ability of on-demand testing has to be part of that priority. Wendy Mim Herold, Vice President of Business and Community Solutions and Northeast Iowa Community College, said education, too, will be a top priority for Dubuque's recovery. It's about upskilling those individuals who are currently employed, as well as getting those large number of individuals who have been laid off into skilled positions that are going to help them in our economy, Mim Herold said. One of the things the CARES Act hasn't addressed is funding for the upskilling in education. I feel that is critical to our recovery. Reynolds announced last week she intends to set aside $85 million out of $1.25 billion the state has received in federal coronavirus relief funds for workforce initiatives, including upskilling. Higher education has been really crippled and deeply impacted by the pandemic, Dietzel said. They are what sets us apart from other communities. Businesses follow workforce, and workforce is trained through education. So we have to do everything we can to continue to support and collaborate with not only our community college, but our private education partners. And finally from the front page, Mechanical Menagerie. Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium to unveil the Robot Zoo exhibit by Kaylee Reese. This article is accompanied by a picture of Wendy Scardino, Director of Marketing and Communications, demonstrating how to use the robot chameleon in the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium's newest exhibit, the Robot Zoo, on Tuesday. A giraffe, complete with microphone ears, greets guests to the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium's new exhibit. It is a zoo of clicking and whirring machinery that has taken over the top floor of the Discovery Center. The Robot Zoo features 8 larger-than-life robotic animals and more than a dozen hands-on activities that exemplify animal biomechanics. The exhibit opens Saturday, June 13th, to the public and is based on the book The Robot Zoo by author John Kelly. Wendy Scardino, the Dubuque Museum's Director of Marketing and Communications, said new exhibits are selected to both complement the museum's mission and offer a unique experience for visitors, exactly what the Robot Zoo does. We say that we're part museum, part aquarium, and part science center, and this exhibit brings that together, she said. In addition to the giraffe, a robotic platypus paddles its feet just as the real swimming mammal would, and visitors can move around the head of a robot rhinoceros. A bat with a 10-foot wingspan sits next to a bar where people can test their ability to hang like the robot's real-life counterpart. A robot body shop is set up to show how animal hearts and lungs work through pump machines. Other exhibit features include a multi-eyed grasshopper and a giant squid with a whizzing food grinder in its middle to mimic how the squid eats. A chameleon made of screens exemplifies the reptile's color changes, and a spot has been set up where visitors themselves can blend in with fun backgrounds. A giant housefly also sits next to a swatterfly activity, testing human reflexes against the quick movements of the insect, which Scardino said might be her favorite activity in the exhibit. Since many elements of the exhibit involve touch, museum employees will stand by to disinfect things and keep an eye on how many people are in the exhibit at a time, per COVID-19 guidelines, Scardino said. Gloves will be offered to those who want another layer of protection. We didn't want to take away the high-touch, hands-on nature of the exhibit, she said. The museum has stayed below 50% capacity since it reopened to the public May 23rd, Scardino said, and guests have done well self-social distancing. The museum has done away with the timed ticketed entry that was in place, though guests are still encouraged to purchase tickets ahead of time. Additionally, Scardino said the museum's 4D theater will reopen this weekend, so everything besides animal touch tanks will be available for visitors. Scardino added that the robot zoo was originally set to open Memorial Day weekend, but Illinois COVID-19 restrictions prevented the exhibit from being shipped out of the state in time. The finishing touches on the exhibit's activities and animals have been completed this week with assistance from Evergreen Exhibitions, a San Antonio-based company that sets up exhibits like the Robot Zoo all over the world. Two Evergreen employees working at the museum this week were Douglas Rucker of Lancaster, South Carolina, and Jonathan Bellows of Flint, Michigan. Both men talked about how their jobs were unique and about the attachment they have to the exhibit. "It's kind of like asking, 'What's your favorite child?'" Rucker said jokingly when asked about his favorite animal in the exhibit. "Each child is different." Bellows said he has seen the robot zoo travel through Mexico, Brazil, Romania, and even his home base of Flint last year. "While setting up exhibits calls for quick adaptation to different cultures and languages," he said, "working with the machines grounds each experience in familiarity. When people ask what you do, and you tell them you set up museum exhibits, they say, 'Well, that's kind of neat.' And you say, 'You know, it kind of is,'" he said. "Most of the machines within the robot zoo are analog instead of digital," Bellows said. "This provides a unique experience for kids who are often more familiar with the digitized world on their smartphones than with the mechanics behind the robotic animals," he added. "You're not going to get one of these at home," Bellows said, patting the robotic giraffe head with affection. The Robot Zoo exhibit dates are Saturday, June 13th to Monday, September 7th. Members-only exhibit preview is from 1 to 4 p.m. Friday, June 12th. Exhibit location is on the second floor of the Discovery Center building by the paddle wheel. Cost is included in the price of general admission. Tickets are good for 2 days. Museum hours are 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. daily. And from the Dubuque and Tri-State page, Dubuque County sees number of confirmed infections fall. 5 additional deaths related to the coronavirus pandemic are reported in Iowa. Grant County reaches 100 total cases. Each day, the Telegraph Herald is recapping changes in local COVID-19 testing and recovery. Wednesday's developments included: there were 5 more cases of COVID-19 in Delaware County recorded from 5 p.m. Tuesday to 5 p.m. Wednesday. The county's total stood at 25 cases at the latter time. The number of positive cases in Dubuque County fell by 2 in the same time period. Declines are typically due to a case being originally attributed to the wrong county. No additional deaths were reported in either Delaware County or Dubuque County during that 24-hour span. Dubuque County's COVID-19 related death toll remains at 21, while Delaware County has just 1 death. A total of 213 people in Dubuque County confirmed to have the coronavirus have recovered, according to the most recent state data, while 17 have recovered in Delaware County. As of 5 p.m. Wednesday, the state website reported that 6,476 Dubuque County residents have been tested, up 149 from the previous day. For the first time since May 29th, the number of positive cases at Dubuque Specialty Care rose, with the additional case bringing the total to 50. The number of recovered patients, 14, remains the same. There are 38 long-term care facilities in Iowa with COVID-19 outbreaks, down 1 from Tuesday. Specialty care is the only long-term care facility outbreak in Dubuque County. As of Wednesday, 245 Iowans were hospitalized due to COVID-19, 10 fewer than Tuesday. The number of Dubuque County residents hospitalized remains at 5. Statewide, 13,628 Iowans have recovered, an increase of 274 from Tuesday. The number of cases in Clayton, Jones, and Jackson counties remained unchanged from Tuesday to Wednesday, though each county tallied more tests. Statewide, 388 new cases were recorded between 5 p.m. Tuesday and 5 p.m. Wednesday. The total as of the latter time was 22,626. Five additional related deaths were reported. There have been 631 so far. Grant County, Wisconsin reported one additional case Wednesday, bringing its total to 100. No new cases were reported in Crawford, Iowa, or Lafayette counties in Wisconsin. In Wisconsin, 285 new confirmed cases were reported Wednesday, pushing the state total to 21,593. 10 new deaths were added to the state's official count, now at 671. Joe Davies County, Illinois, had one additional positive case Wednesday, bringing its total to 34 positive cases. In Illinois, 625 new cases and 77 additional deaths were reported Wednesday. That pushed the state's totals to 129,837 cases and 6,095 deaths. And still on the Dubuque and Tri-State page, backers sow REAP extension idea to lawmakers. Popular Iowa program will end unless action is taken during the resumed 2020 legislative session, by Benjamin Fisher. At Eagle Point Park in Dubuque, the first stems of native prairie plants have risen from the ground. Just planted in the fall of 2019, these plants in the coming years will help restore the areas to historic oak savanna, saving soil from running off the blufftop park, absorbing water, and providing crucial habitat for native species. The City of Dubuque project was made possible with a $200,000 grant from the Iowa Resource Enhancement and Protection Program. But now, the fate of REAP, the state's premier natural resource, outdoor recreation, and historic preservation fund, is in Iowa lawmakers' hands as they returned to complete the 2020 legislative session. Since being passed in 1989, the program has provided $26.4 million for 901 projects in Clayton, Delaware, Dubuque, Jackson, and Jones counties. That is in addition to regular allocations to counties based on population. This program is so very important, said Dubuque Leisure Services Manager Marie Ware. Its impact just in Dubuque County alone is tremendous for its natural resources, our park areas. The types of projects it does affects the quality of life and make Dubuque a great place to live in. Ware pointed, too, to the city trail that connects to the Heritage Trail as an example of a project finished incrementally through REAP funding over years. We would not have that resource if we did not have REAP, she said. But when REAP went into effect in 1990, it did so with a 30-year sunset. Unless lawmakers this year vote to reauthorize or extend the program, it will end. Area lawmakers from both parties and both chambers have supported REAP, but agricultural and small government lobbies have attacked its provisions for purchasing private land for public use. Dubuque County Conservation Executive Director Brian Preston said REAP helped with the purchase of Whitewater Canyon Wildlife Area and dozens of trails in other county parks. It also paid for Swiss Valley Nature Center just outside of Dubuque. We've been very lucky to utilize REAP dollars on pretty monumental projects, he said. REAP is the most important thing for outdoor recreation in the state. Jackson County Environmental Education Coordinator Jessica Wagner lauded REAP's multifaceted approach, from paying for programming like hers at Hertzville Interpretive Center in Maquoketa to planting roadside vegetation. When you drive Iowa's highways, planting those native prairie perennials not only provides some beauty, but helps filter the runoff for those highways and provides habitat for wildlife, she said. Delaware County Conservation Executive Director Garland Glanz said REAP funding has been beneficial in many respects. REAP is an important component of funding to help with the replacement of aging infrastructure and/or development of new facilities to help meet the ever-increasing demands of outdoor recreation from the public, he said. And next, Union Family Pharmacy offering free COVID-19 testing. Dubuque Business has been selected to offer the service in collaboration with a national public-private partnership by Benjamin Fisher. A family-owned pharmacy in Dubuque this week began offering COVID-19 testing, with those being tested collecting their own samples. Throughout Tuesday and Wednesday, a green and white sign stuck in the ground outside Union Family Pharmacy, 2541 Central Avenue, beaten by steady rain, reading, COVID-19 test collection site, stay in car, windows up. Co-owner Linda Nightingale said it was a complete surprise when the pharmacy received word recently that it had been selected as part of a national public-private partnership to offer the testing. But she said it was thrilled to do so. If you have an employee who tests positive, you need to know if it's safe for them to come back to work, Linda said. I know that can take a long time. The program is driven by a partnership among U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, McKesson Medical, which is Union Family Pharmacy's wholesaler, and testing company E-True North. According to co-owner Eric Nightingale, Union Family has no limit on the number of collection kits it is to receive and has the capacity to conduct about 48 tests per day. It's only limited based on our own ability to have people come in and perform the test, he said. We have certain times a day when we can do the test. Appointment slots are currently available from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday, and on Saturday from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. through the end of June. To participate, residents need to meet eligibility requirements, which Eric Nightingale stressed were not set by Union Family Pharmacy. People interested in being tested must fill out a questionnaire based on guidelines from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on E-True North's COVID-19 website at doineedacovid19test.com. If people then meet the criteria, they can set an appointment at their nearest participating pharmacy. Pharmacy staff will come to the vehicle and hang the collection kit on the side mirror. The patient then will be responsible for collecting his or her own sample with guidance from the staff. These are nasopharyngeal swabs that reach the back of the nasal cavity for a good test. Results are expected in 3 to 5 business days. People must qualify through the website and set up an appointment to be tested. No walk-ins are allowed. Reached by the Telegraph Herald, public health officials on the Dubuque County COVID-19 Incident Management Division team said they supported additional COVID-19 testing, but did not know enough about the program or tests in which people collect their own samples to comment. Dubuque County's medical liaison for the COVID-19 pandemic, Bobby Conneroo, voiced similar sentiments. I'm glad that testing is becoming more accessible to the community, he said. That's needed. As far as this test goes, though, I am just not familiar. Loras giving more choices to students. Loras College will allow students to choose whether they want to attend in person or online this fall. The school announced Wednesday that it will deliver instruction through a hybrid teaching model called Loras Flex this fall. The program provides a combination of in-person and online teaching that can accommodate students who are present on campus as well as those who wish to pursue their education entirely online, according to a press release. Students will have the option to study and live on campus, commute to campus, or take their classes online. Students spent the final months of their spring semester learning online because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Loras officials also are modifying their 2020-2021 academic calendar. The fall semester will start August 26th and continue to November 20th when students leave for Thanksgiving break. After that, the last week of classes and final exams will be held online. Officials also are freezing tuition and fees and will use social distancing practices in academic spaces, among other changes. You are listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Thursday, June 11th, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to Iowa's obituaries. Marcella M. Marcy Dendinger Wilming, 98, of Dubuque, was called home peacefully at 7:10 a.m. on Tuesday, June 9th, at Hawkeye Care Center. To celebrate Marcella's life, private family services will be held at Bear Funeral Home, 1491 Main Street. Burial will be at Mount Calvary Cemetery. Marcy was born on December 8, 1921, in Dubuque, the only child of Clarence and Rosina Grill Dedinger. Marcy attended St. Mary's Grade School and St. Joseph High School before going to work with the Dubuque Casket Company. She was united in marriage to the love of her life, Arthur Wilming, on November 16, 1946, at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Dubuque. They were blessed with 56 wonderful years together and four children, before he was sadly called home ahead of her on December 5, 2002. After they married, Marcy fully embraced her role as a full-time wife, mother, and homemaker. Her faith was an integral part of her life, as evidenced by her lifelong membership with St. Mary's Catholic Church and Rosary Society. In her free time, Marcy and Art enjoyed getting together with friends, playing cards, or going dancing at Melody Mill. They moved to the Woodlands and made many new friends, and after Art's passing, Marcy could be found playing cards or bingo every day. It was hard to find her in her apartment. She truly was the definition of a social butterfly. We are eternally grateful for the 98 years we have had here with Marcy, and she has experienced more changes in her lifetime than most can imagine. We love you and look forward to the day when we are all happily reunited in our heavenly home together. Marcy's family would like to thank the outstanding nurses and staff of Hawkeye Care Center, especially Danny, as well as Hospice of Dubuque, especially Megan, Shirley, Kelly, and Amy B., and her hospice social worker, Jenny. You have all been wonderful, and your support and care are deeply appreciated. In lieu of flowers, memorials will be accepted by the family to be distributed between Hawkeye Care Center and Hospice of Dubuque and may be mailed to Bear Funeral Home, 1491 Main Street, Dubuque, Iowa, 52001, Attention Marcella Wilming Family. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.bearfuneralhome.com. Princeton R. Gillenwater, 5, of Dubuque, died June 6th. To celebrate Princeton's life, family and friends may visit from 12 p.m. noon to 1 p.m. on Saturday, June 13th, at Bear Funeral Home, 1491 Main Street. To honor Princeton's life, funeral services will be held immediately following the visitation at 1 p.m. Saturday at the funeral home. Patrick E. Chubbs Fishnick, Sr., 71, of Dubuque, died June 5th. Pat's celebration of life will be held on Monday, June 15th, from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the American Legion Hall, 1306 Delhi Street. Burial will be in Memorial Gardens. Edward J. Lucan, 79, of New Vienna, died June 10th. Visitation will be held from 2 to 8 p.m. Sunday, June 14th, at Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville. A mass of Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. Monday, June 15th, at St. Boniface Catholic Church in New Vienna. Burial will be in the church cemetery. Kate Peterson, 77, of Dubuque, died Wednesday, June 10th. A memorial service will be held at 2 p.m. Saturday at the Egelhoff, Sigurd, and Casper Westview Funeral Home, 2659 Kennedy Road, where visitation will be Saturday from noon until time of service. Complete arrangements are pending. Anne Margaret Wagner, 98, of Lancaster, died Tuesday, June 9th, at Orchard Manor in Lancaster. A private family service will be held. Thornburg Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, is assisting the family. Sheila A. Buss, 70, of Prairie du Chien, died June 8th. Private family funeral services will be held at Martin Schwartz Funeral Home and Crematory in Lancaster. Burial will be at a later date. Jude Allen Coughlin, 31, of Dubuque, died Tuesday, June 9th. Complete arrangements are pending at the Egelhoff Cedar and Casper Westview Funeral Home and Crematory, 2659 Kennedy Road. John W. Butts, 92, of Galena, died June 10th at his residence. Arrangements are pending at the Furlong Funeral Chapel in Galena. John S. Rodham, 91, of Dubuque, passed away Monday, June 8th. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, June 13th, at St. Joseph the Worker Catholic Church, with Reverend Tom McDermott officiating. Burial will be at Mount Olivet Cemetery. Visitation will be from 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. Friday, June 12th, at the Egelhoff Sigurd and Casper Westview Funeral Home and Crematory, 2659 JFK Road. Due to COVID-19 and current health guidelines, the family and funeral home require half capacity in the funeral home, along with recommending utilizing masks and practicing proper social distancing. The family understands if you are unable to attend, please be with us in prayer. John was born on January 1, 1929 in Dubuque, the son of John P. and Martha Manders Rodham. He married Helen Sullivan on October 2, 1954, at the Church of the Nativity. John was a loving husband, wonderful father, grandpa, and great-grandpa. He was a perfectionistic plasterer for Frank Hamill and Son, retiring after 45 years of service. John has been a member of St. Joseph the Worker Parish for the past 61 years and was an avid hunter, entertaining storytelling, and staunch Iowa Hawkeyes fan. In lieu of flowers, a John S. Rodham Memorial Fund has been established. John's family would like to thank Dr. Mark Rundy and the nurses and staff of By Your Side Care, especially Lisa, Michelle, Laura, Maria, Inna, Olivia, and Rebecca, for their wonderful care and compassion. Nicholas A. Close, age 39, a resident of La Crosse, Wisconsin, entered eternal life on Wednesday, June 3rd, at the family residence with family by his side. Nick was born on March 25, 1981, in Two Rivers. He was the son of Robert and Christine Close Kentkin, Jr. Nick attended Washington High School in Two Rivers and graduated with the class of 1999. He then continued his education at the University of Wisconsin-Manitowoc for the next 2 years, followed by 2 years at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, where he received his Bachelor of Science degree in Business Management and Accounting in 2004. Nick was a retail manager at Kmart. On June 5, 2010, he married Nicole Robertson in La Crosse. He loved to cook, hunt, go fishing with his grandpa, play chess, soccer, go swimming, and enjoying the lakeshore area. Nick was an avid Redskins football fan. Memorial services will be held at 4 p.m. on Friday, June 19th, at the Harrigan Parkside Funeral Home. Officiating will be the Reverend Bo Perkins. Following the memorial service, a life celebration social will follow until 7 p.m. at the Harrigan Parkside Gathering Center, located on the south property of the funeral home. Online condolences to the family may be sent to www.harriganparksidefuneralhome.com. The Harrigan Parkside Funeral Home and Crematory, North 11th and St. Clair Streets, Manitowoc, is assisting the family with funeral arrangements. Elizabeth A. Betty Junk, age 88, of Cassville, Wisconsin, passed away Tuesday, June 9th, at Lancaster Health Services. She was born December 28, 1931, on the Weber family farm in Bloomington Township, the daughter of Anton Tony and Frances Wegman Weber. On August 28, 1950, Betty was united into marriage to Lauren M. Junk. Together, they farmed in Little Grant Township. In 1961, Lauren and Betty purchased the town pump in Cassville and operated the bar until 1977. Betty also worked for Cassville Schools, Scogmo Clothing Store, and Sherman's Wisconsin Cheese Country in B-Town. She was a member of St. Charles Catholic Church, its Alder Society, and CCW. Betty and Lauren enjoyed vacationing, going out to eat, playing cards, and entertaining family and friends. She was devoted to her family, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. Due to the current remodeling at St. Charles Catholic Church in Cassville, a mass of Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, June 13th, at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Bloomington, Wisconsin, with Father John Meinholz officiating. Burial will be in St. Charles Cemetery, Cassville. Family and friends may call from 9 a.m. until time of services at the church. Martin Schwartz Funeral Home and Crematory in Cassville is assisting the family. We wish to extend our gratitude to Park Place Memory Care in Platteville, all nurses and staff of Lancaster Health Services, and Bobby Joe, Sarah, Deanna, and Monica from St. Croix Hospice for their special care. Online condolences at www.martin-schwartzfuneralhomes.com. Funeral services. Most funeral homes and churches are practicing social distancing guidelines recommended by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Please contact specific locations for more information. Mary Beth Althoff, Cascade, Iowa. Services at 10:30 a.m. today, St. Martin's Catholic Church in Cascade. Merlin A. Bogue, of Manchester, Iowa. Services at 10:30 a.m. today, at St. Mary Catholic Church in Manchester. Christopher J. Herrig of Dubuque. Services at 12 noon Thursday, June 18th at Nativity Church. Celebration of Life from 4 to 8 p.m. Thursday, June 18th at Happy's Place. Craig W. Kohler of Dubuque. Services at 10:30 a.m. today, Grandview United Methodist Church. Visitation from 9 to 10:15 a.m. today at the church. Jean Leiden of Waukon. Graveside services 11 a.m. Saturday, June 13th at Mount Olivet Cemetery in Waukon. Constance M. Manders of Bernard, Iowa. Memorial service at 10 a.m. Saturday, June 13th, St. Patrick's Catholic Church, Gary Owen, Iowa. Deborah R. Hines Bandy Roth of Dubuque, formerly of Dyersville, Iowa. Services at 11 a.m. Friday, June 12th at Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville. Visitation from 2 to 8 p.m. today and from 10 to 11 a.m. Friday at the funeral home. Dennis R. Whalen of Vinton, Iowa. Graveside services at 11 a.m. today, St. Mary's Lycurgus Cemetery, in Waukon, Iowa. And now from the sports page, Telegraph Herald Athlete of the Week, Tommy Casey of Dubuque Senior. Casey leaves legacy at senior. St. Ambrose recruit set several records during his senior year. By Shannon Mum. Dubuque Senior's Tommy Casey rewrote the record books during his senior football season. The Telegraph Herald Athlete of the Week recently earned the distinguished honor of Male Athlete of the Year at Dubuque Senior High School after breaking 6 passing records as the team's 2-year starting quarterback. Casey set records for passing yards in a game, passing yards in a season, all-time career leader in passing yards, passes completed in a season, passes completed in a year, and passing touchdowns in a game. Tommy really shined for us last year, Dubuque senior football coach Dale Plosel said. He was extremely motivated and wanted nothing more than for his team to be successful. He was the first one at workouts and the last to leave, and he always wanted to continue learning. The St. Ambrose signee finished his career with 1,957 passing yards while throwing for 13 touchdowns and running for 4 more. He set the school record for passing yards in a game with 406 and touchdowns in a game, 5, against Cedar Rapids Prairie. The football season was very exciting. It was just a great time with great friends, Casey said. All of the experience I gained over the years has really benefited me as an athlete. I am excited for the opportunity to play in Davenport this fall, especially being so close to home and getting a chance to play at Clark in the upcoming years. Casey credited his teammates, coaches, and family for his success. I don't get to this point without them, he said. They have all supported me the entire way. A tireless work ethic also helped pave the way for Casey. I made it a point to come in before school every morning to work with Coach Plessel and to spend as much time as I could in the weight room to work on getting faster and stronger, Casey said. Casey also earned the respect of his teammates during his role as the team's quarterback. He really improved over the years just by taking the time to learn the game, Plosel said. He turned into a great leader for us, and he always did what he could to help his teammates along the way. Casey split his time between football and baseball for the majority of his high school career until deciding to put all of his focus on football his senior year. All of this stuff with COVID-19 has been crazy, and I just want the extra time to work on football, he said. I enjoyed the time I got to play baseball, and it taught me a lot of things. Next, under college football, Clark Pride. Fall season details emerge. Clark coach reacts to modifications, shortened schedule. By Brendan West. One of the biggest questions facing college sports right now is whether or not a fall season will even happen. Last week, the NAIA put a plan in writing, which means, among other things, a return for Clark Athletics in a couple of months. The NAIA released its fall season modifications on June 4th, roughly a month before the division was expected to make an announcement. The new procedures call for a return to play threshold, designating that at least half of the schools that sponsor a given sport must receive clearance to play. For example, 47 of NAIA's 95 football programs must gain clearance to hold a football season. Delayed start dates. The first football games will be September 12th, allowing for 4 weeks of practice prior. All other fall sports can begin competition on September 5th. A scaled-down competition schedule. Football decreased from 11 games to 9, cross-country moved from 8 meets to 7, soccer will play 14 games instead of 18, and women's volleyball decreased from 28 matches to 22. The NAIA also intends to hold each of its fall national championship tournaments as currently scheduled, although the division cannot predict what will happen in the next 6 months. College sports at all levels have been in somewhat of a holding pattern since the coronavirus pandemic caused the cancellation of athletics nationwide back in March. After extensive consultation by the Council of Presidents Executive Committee, the NAIA decided to release its decision earlier in order to allow schools to make plans. Clark football coach Miguel Regalado said the university is already scrambling to make preparations on how fall athletes will make their return. I was excited that the NAIA took initiative and jumped out in front, said Regalado, noting that the NCAA hasn't issued a concrete plan in the way the NAIA has. Some people will ask if we're being safe. I think we are. The NAIA's modification mean that Clark football lost its season opener at Central Methodist August 29th and Week 2 home opener against Missouri Valley September 5th. The Pride will instead open their football season at Evangel on September 12 and play a 9-game schedule within the Heart of America Athletic Conference. Losing 2 games on the schedule isn't ideal for a second-year program like Clark's, Regalado said, but it's an understandable move and a relatively small price to pay when considering how much time it takes to prepare athletes in fall camps and for that first football game. Just the fact that we're playing football is huge, Regalado said, adding that the announcement solidifies student-athlete concerns about whether they'll be allowed to return to campus. I understand why they did what they did. You've got to have adequate time and safety for your athletes to compete. With this thing, with COVID-19, I'm glad that the NAIA and Hart has come out and said we're going to play football. We're sending a message that we fully intend to compete in 2020. Clark is in the process of a phased move-in for fall athletes. Regalado said his players would be allowed to arrive to campus on August 8th, and other sports will be welcomed back in waves. The first day of classes is planned for August 24th. The institution is also in the process of working through social distancing parameters in order to limit exposure to coronavirus, which is expected to linger into the fall. For football, this is an especially challenging hurdle given the physical nature and sheer number of participants within the sport. Nothing will be the same. Not the way we worked out, not the way we practice, not the way our kids return to campus, Regalado said. All of those things are going to be examined, and we're going to come up with the best way to do it. We've got a couple of months here to iron this out. The main thing on our plate is what's the safest way to bring our kids back to campus. The NAIA also announced that at this time, there are no planned changes for the winter sports season. The division will evaluate the possible impact of COVID-19 on the winter season and prioritize any decisions that will help our institutions prepare for possible adjustment if necessary. Under sports in brief, NCAA finalizing plan for college football preseason. After the pandemic wiped out spring practice for most major college football teams, an NCAA plan to extend the preseason by 2 weeks could help coaches and players make up for the lost time. The NCAA's Football Oversight Committee expects to finalize a plan on Thursday to allow teams to conduct up to 12 unpadded, slow-speed practices, also known as walkthroughs, during the 14 days before the typical preseason begins in August. Teams will be permitted up to 20 hours per week of what the NCAA calls countable athletically related activities during those extra 2 weeks, leading into a normal 29-day preseason practice schedule. The walkthroughs will be part of those 20 hours per week, along with weight training, conditioning, film study, and meetings. Players will not be permitted to wear pads or helmets during walkthroughs, which cannot exceed 1 hour per day. In baseball, Manfred guarantees MLB season will happen. Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred says there is a 100% chance of big league ball this year. Major League Baseball will make another proposal to start the pandemic-delayed season in empty ballparks, but Manfred vowed Wednesday to unilaterally order opening day if an agreement is not reached. I can tell you unequivocally we are going to play Major League Baseball this year, he said. And that does it for today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Thursday, June 11th, 2020. I'm your reader, Ralph Skippers. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. As always, thanks for listening, and be safe.